Clear for takeoff, runway 28 left, fly runway heading.
Welcome to another brand new episode of Living in Flight, your go-to podcast for everything in the world of aviation. Exclusive interview conversations with industry professionals and enthusiasts. Strap on your seatbelt.
Put on your headset.
And get ready for Living in Flight.
What's up, everyone? It's Matt. Drew wasn't able to make our episode this week, but I had the chance to sit down solo and talk all things aviation with Shane Van Hoven. Shane is currently an air traffic controller in the tower at the Chicago O'Hare International Airport. In this episode, we talk about Shane's non-traditional route he took to get into ATC, why he dropped out of college, the intense training he went through, and how he was able to get into one of the busiest work environments at such a young age, so early in his career. This conversation was a lot of fun, and I hope you all learned something like I did. Enjoy.
Yeah, so I'm Shane Van Hoven, air traffic controller at Chicago O'Hare. And,
Where are you from?
Oh, Minnetonka, Minnesota, yeah. Nice, I'm already screwing up.
No, you're good. No. Do you come from an aviation family?
You know, it's interesting because I never really considered it to be an aviation family.
Okay.
But I do have, like, my cousin flies for Delta, my other cousin's in the Air Force.
Nice.
Another cousin works for used to work for a company that designs like seats and stuff for airplanes. So it's like, cool. I actually have a few connections in aviation, but I never really thought of it that way. And then my uncle is a private pilot and he flies for fun on the side.
Okay.
But I was kind of just into aviation before any of that, like ever since, I don't know what age, but really, really young.
Just watching airplanes fly over.
And yeah, I mean, we would go on our summer vacation, our one trip a year on a plane, and it would just, you know, I'd be super excited about just it. And
attached to the window, looking at them all go
exactly,
by.
Exactly, yeah.
It's the same way. I feel like a lot of people in the industry are like that.
Yeah, it's totally a bug, I think, that catch.
And it bites hard.
Yeah, totally, yeah.
But like nobody, parents or anybody wasn't a pilot or anything like that. Nobody.
No, they weren't, but they were extremely supportive.
Yeah.
And like they could tell right early on that that's what I wanted. And so they were all for it. And,
Did you go to school for air traffic control then? What did you do?
So, when I was in high school, I learned to fly. I was doing my private when I was 16 and did my check ride when right after I turned 17.
Nice. Did you solo on your 16th birthday?
No, actually. I was, back or rewind to even before that, I was like planning this all out because part of the thing, my dad is so into like planning things. He wants to know what the plan is and everything.
Yeah.
And so he's like, you need to figure out how you're going to do this, like the timing and everything. And you need to figure out like how you're going to stay current after you get your thing. And you're going to figure out like what you're going to do in college and like make all this planned so that there's no surprises, you know,
which is, that's a great mindset.
Yeah.
Getting into aviation.
Yeah, looking back on it, it's seriously good. And so when I was 15 or turning 16, I was deciding like, you know, I probably shouldn't start flying when I'm 15 and solo on my 16th birthday because then I have a whole year that I have to fill up until I can get my license.
Yeah, that makes
sense. That's just money, you know?
Right, yeah.
And, you know, looking back, it's not a big deal because all that time counts for your logbook anyway. Right. Yeah. So it's not that big of a deal. But, so I decided to wait until I was in, like, well into my 16th year to start actually, like, flying hard.
Yeah.
But my uncle gave me for my birthday or Christmas or something a Discovery flight. And that's what kind of jump-started me into it and did that and then rolled right into flight training.
Nice. So now, I guess, how many hours do you have now? Do you still fly? Do you stay current at all?
I haven't been current for a while.
No? Okay.
I had 220 or something like that.
Just a private pilot rating? No, do you have an instrument?
Ever since I've been in air traffic, I've kind of I'm not losing interest, but it just hasn't been a priority.
Yeah,
you know?
That makes sense.
I've just been, you know, busy with work and other, you know, life stuff. So it's kind of taking a backseat now, but
that makes sense. So you get your private, you get you're flying around, you graduate high school. What's next?
Yeah. I actually did my instrument too when I was in school.
Oh, okay. So you do have an instrument.
Yeah. I rolled right into it because, you know, at this point, during my private pilot training is when I started to get into air traffic control a little bit.
Okay.
For the private pilot ground school, we toured Flying Cloud Tower.
Nice.
It's kind of silly. Like, we were there during sunset and it was pretty slow at the airport at the time. And so I was like looking at the controls, like, you guys are getting paid to just watch the sunset and like hang out and stuff. And I was like, that's pretty cool. And so then I looked into it more, and over the next few months or whatever, really decided that that's what I wanted to pursue.
Nice.
And so this was getting into like my senior year of high school, and I needed to figure out what I want to do for college. Mm-hmm. And at the time, the FAA was changing around how their hiring practice was going.
Sure.
Up until that time, you had to go to a CTI school and like get a degree in air traffic control,
right,
and get put on a list to get hired. And that was the only way to get hired.
Yeah. Go to like a UND or something.
Yeah.
Like
UND that. Or a Beaver County or a, you know, I think Western Michigan might have one. Embry-Riddle has one. They, you know, they all have
it's a dedicated program.
Yeah. For air traffic control. And, they were moving to a new process that didn't necessarily require that degree.
Okay.
So I, you know, going back to this whole plan thing, I didn't want to just go to a degree that wasn't going to guarantee me a job.
Yeah.
I needed something else as a backup, because ever since the beginning, it was never a guarantee that I was going to get hired.
Right.
You know? And, so I ended up, ruling out UND, cause I didn't want to go all the way up there to like, I wanted to work in college. I wanted to, you know, gain experience and whatever, because that's just who I am, is I want to work and I don't want to just go out and party and stuff.
Yeah.
And so I chose Mankato because it was close and I could come back here and work on my days off.
Yeah.
And so I only ended up having class like Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. And then Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, I'd work here on the line at Elliott.
That's awesome. And were you just doing it? Were you doing an aviation management degree?
Yeah, it was aviation management. Okay. Yeah. Just as a backup.
Yeah.
Like if air traffic wasn't going to work out, at least I'd have a degree in like a generic business degree
that could be practical down the road.
And at the time I was still staying current. And so flying wasn't totally out of the question as a backup too. So
did you ever want to be like a professional pilot?
Yeah, what I was flying originally for. Yeah. Okay. I wanted to be a pilot. And then
seeing the tower kind of.
Yeah. Well, and then doing the instrument training too. Instrument is way more involved with air traffic too.
Right.
And so learning about all those procedures and stuff really just propelled my interest even more. I wanted to learn more about what the other side of the flying mic was going on. What was happening on the other side. So that's awesome. And then just over the course of I don't know, ever since that tour in the tower up until getting into college, I was just learning more and more about it. I would tour the center, tour the Tricon.
Okay, so you've done them all.
Yeah, yeah, you know, I wanted to go see the real thing. I didn't want to just read about it in books. I didn't, you know what I'm saying? So
You beat the COVID wave for that. I know. I've wanted to try and get in. I've been into a couple towers, but I'd like to get into more and do more. But
I definitely recommend it to anybody listening who's just involved in aviation at all. Like, try to get into the facilities and
I know they're pretty willing to
people up. Yeah. It's awesome. I mean, right now with COVID, obviously you can't, but
it'll come back eventually.
It sounds like we're trying to get it back. I mean, ever since I certified at O'Hare, I've been trying to go visit the Tricon because it's a separate facility.
Oh, sure.
But we work really close with each other. Yeah. And so it'd be really good for me to go like see what they're dealing
what they
with
do
them and just to learn their side a little bit. But
is it on the field? Is it on the field
there? No, it's 25 miles away in Elgin. Oh, okay. Yeah. It used to be co-located, but then they split it off. So
makes sense. So you're working on the line, you're going to school for aviation management. Mm-hmm. How did you keep the air traffic control how were you helping yourself get to that position with the FAA? What were you doing? Were you doing anything? Did you have an application in? Were you just waiting for a call? What was the process that you had to go through being that you didn't go to a UND or a different school like that? How was that process different for you?
Yeah. So at this point they had switched over to the new hiring process. And instead of having just a list of people that they pull from the CDI schools, they have open bids on the USA Jobs website.
Mm-hmm.
And they would open it like once a year, for a week or whatever.
Yeah.
And, so I was just basically waiting for a bid to come out.
Okay.
And, the requirements to be qualified were 3 years of work experience or a four-year degree or a combination of work okay. and experience. And so because I started working like, you know, casually with InFlyt when I was 16,
right,
I counted all that as work experience because it was.
Yeah.
And thank by you. The time I was a year into college, I counted a year of college and then like 4 years of part-time work as enough to.
Yeah. You're like, this is it.
You know what? It counts,
yeah.
whatever.
Yeah.
And so I was qualified when I was a year into college.
Okay.
And so I applied, went through the first biographical like questionnaire thing, which is a whole different conversation for a whole other okay. year. I don't really want to get into it.
That's all right.
But ended up not passing at that time.
Okay.
And then the next year they had another bid.
So they just say, hey, try again next yeah. time it's open.
Yeah. Okay. They don't bar you from trying it again. Yeah. They just,
that's cool.
Yeah. I mean, it would be ridiculous for them to do so because there's so many people that fail it for no reason.
I'm sure. Yeah.
So then the next year I applied, they changed it a little bit. The biographical questionnaire, they changed it a little bit.
Okay.
Ended up passing for some reason. I don't understand how you fail at once.
What is the basic gist of this biographical?
It test? Asks things like, oh gosh, I can't even remember.
Is it like a personality assessment? It's kind of like a cognitive screening.
It's more personality based okay. rather than cognitive based. Does the cognitive tests go happen later in the process.
Okay.
It'd be like, when you're in a group project, are you taking charge of the group or are you like
and there's
following
like a scale
somebody?
Of four yeah, answers
like, from like yeah somewhat or mostly you know yeah. all the scale of answers
okay
and I don't remember how many questions but there was 50 or 60 of them and it's okay. just you know I don't yeah. know what are you supposed to answer I don't right. know. And so the second time I took it I literally just did it the same way. I wasn't going to lie about it because
this is who I am
you know and then passed so hey, go figure
must have grown a lot in that previous year.
So this was second year of college, or I guess after the second year of college. The bid opened in the fall. And so I took the questionnaire in the fall. And then the process of getting hired is so long mm-hmm. that I went through those two semesters of school, finished it, went into the summer, and it was still in the process of doing like
wow,
the
that's
rest.
A, yeah. That's a long yeah. time.
And I didn't end up going to the academy until the following September. So it was a year from applying to actually getting hired.
Wow. So then did you drop out of college?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I wasn't going to drop out until I had a final offer.
Right.
And so over the course of that year of, you know, BQ was in when the bid happened in August or whatever,
mm-hmm.
It's like a month to figure out if you pass that. And then I can't remember the order of everything, but the next like 8 months is the, like there's medical, there's cognitive tests, mm-hmm. which are like little video games that you had to play to.
Yeah,
test whether or not
I've done those for jobs.
Yeah, there's that. There's the background check and the security clearance and mm-hmm. all that stuff. And just because it's the government, it just takes a long time.
Yeah,
that's just how it goes. And got a tentative offer letter after I passed one of the steps or something.
Sure.
Then you do the whatever remaining steps. I can't remember the order, so I'm sorry for not having those details.
Hey, that's good.
And then we got a final offer letter in the summer at some point for a class date in September at the academy.
When we talked to a former or another air traffic controller, he was saying that when he was applying, this was, you know, many years ago, that they had, you could one list like the states that you wanted to be in. You could list if you wanted to be, what did he call it? Like, mm-hmm. you know, a tower controller or a center controller. Yeah. I don't remember the two terms that he used, but like basically if you wanted to be, if you're willing to go wherever, how did that work for you? Was it just a, cause I know, you know, I know that the positions are where they need you and you're kind of at their mercy of to where they're going to put you. But did you have any say if it was going to be a tower controller versus a center controller or how did that
there was go? there was no say for me. Okay. In my announcement bid, I think they were doing half and half until or so terminal versus en route. Those were
yes,
probably
that's
the two
what
terms
he was saying. Wow, I should know that.
So terminal is tower and tracons. and en route is the centers.
Yeah. And did they split that out, or they were just, when you applied, it was half was going one way, half was going the other?
Well, yeah, it wasn't chosen until they were doing the final offers.
Okay. Yeah.
Which was in the summer before I went in September.
Yeah.
But I believe what they did is they had a certain number of slots for en route and a certain number of slots for terminal, and there were more slots for en route.
Okay.
And so they did one for one. They just alternated picking one until they ran out of terminal slots.
And yeah. And then the rest got en route.
So, I mean, it was random, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't really know which bucket. I fell in the terminal
bucket. Cool.
Which I am thankful for, because I don't think I would have enjoyed the center so much.
Yeah.
So you knew going into the academy that you were going to go to either a terminal facility or an en route facility.
Right.
And in the terminal side of things, you would get placed in level 4 through 7.
Okay.
So there's 4 through 12 for the whole range. And out of the academy, they place you 4 to 7.
And 4 through 12. And that's based on size of the
airport. Yeah, like traffic volume, complexity. You know, if there's mountains, that adds to it.
Okay, sure.
Basically just the overall like difficulty, I guess.
Sure. So, which makes sense. Stick you in a little easier place to start.
Yeah, it makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So then did they give you any options, or was there a list of all of them when you showed up, or
no.
Did you know? You don't know until when you find that out.
You found out so a week before the final evals, they gave you a list of what it might be.
Okay.
And it's changed since I went through, but when I went through, they gave you a list, which is 2 facilities per person in your class.
Okay.
So we had 18 people in our class, and so they gave 36 options on our list.
Okay.
And then, it was just a sample list of what it might be.
Right. It wasn't guaranteed or set in stone.
It's not going to set. Yeah. And so then we finished the last week of training, do the evals, and then after the evals, we ended up passing 8 people in our, or 9 people in our class.
Okay.
And 18 people failed, unfortunately.
Wow.
Or did I say 18? Eight people. 9 people failed, 9 people passed.
So they just went home?
Yeah, they fired.
Really?
Yeah.
Holy smokes.
Yeah. It's, again, that's another conversation for another time, which I don't really want to get into.
Wow, because
I don't think I'm really allowed to state my opinions on stuff like that.
Hey, that's...
But,
That's crazy.
And it's really unfortunate, because I would really only say there's 1 or 2 people that really shouldn't have passed.
Right.
The rest of them, I think, could have made it to a facility and could have been trainable.
Yeah.
And... it's really frustrating now being somewhere that's so short-staffed. And we're short-staffed nationwide.
Right, yeah.
We need people bad.
Yeah.
And at least give them another opportunity to go to the en route side and try it. You know? Fired, go home.
Wow.
Find something else to do.
That's after how long that process is to you and how long they drag you along. That's crazy.
So the 8 people that passed get sat into the room, and then we're given the final list, which is still 2 per person that passed. Mm-hmm. So 8 or 9 people passed, 18 choices of facilities.
Yep.
And they were all over the place. There was Burbank, California. There was Jackson, Mississippi. There was Bangor, Maine.
Okay.
Cedar Rapids, Iowa was on there. Just some, random places.
Did you have one that you were looking at?
So I was looking at, I wanted to go to the highest level facility, because when you get placed into a terminal facility, sometimes just the way the luck works out, you get stuck there.
Yeah.
Because the staffing might not be great. And so if you want to get out, you might not be able to.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to go to the busiest facility so that if I were to get stuck, at least I'd have a lower chance of being bored.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And I always knew I wanted to be at some big facility. And so I just didn't want to be at the Cedar Rapids, where the tower in the winter might see 10 operations in an hour or a day.
A day.
I don't know. I don't know what it is.
Probably not much.
Yeah. And, so that's what I was looking at. And, Burbank was a 7, and we had Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, which was a 7 up down, which is tower and radar.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And there were like Jackson, Mississippi was, I think, a 6 or 7 up down. And so radar would have been a nice thing.
And Burbank didn't have
that. Burbank didn't have radar because we were under SoCal.
That makes sense.
And so I was just looking at the places that hopefully I wouldn't get bored.
Yeah.
You know?
And then do you get to rank
based on the class
one through
rank, yeah.
whatever? And where did you fall in the class?
I was second from the bottom, actually.
Okay. Yeah.
And take that as you will as how the rankings go, but you know, second from the bottom is now working at O'Hare. So
yeah, and it doesn't
really
matter.
Mean much,
yeah.
You know, I mean the scoring is super objective to a fault at the academy.
Sure. Yeah.
And you make one little mistake and it snowballs
and
into a million points that you lose.
Sure.
So that's just how it goes. And
it's so cutthroat.
It is cutthroat. And it's, yeah, I mean, it is. So we graduated. That was 3 months at the academy. They give you, there was 2 travel days to go to California. We finished evals on December 15th. And so
what year was this?
2017.
Cool.
And they gave you 2 travel days, plus you can take leave if you want to, the leave that you've accrued in the 3 months that you were there.
Yeah.
And so with Christmas and New Year's being right soon after my graduation date, I was able to come back to Minnesota, hang out for a few weeks. Like,
that's nice.
Hang out with my family for Christmas and New Year's. And then we ended up leaving on the 27th of December to drive out
to Burbank, the new home.
Yeah. The new home. Got there and on New Year's Eve, I think is when we got there.
Yeah.
You know, celebrated New Year's in California and started work on the 2nd. So.
And so you actually learned how to be an air traffic controller prior to graduating, right?
I mean,
so you,
I would use that
months,
term loosely a little
okay,
bit. But, yeah, it's a super sterile air traffic environment. So
right.
you work in the tower sims in a made up, it's called Academy Airport, which has two parallel runways and a crossing runway.
Uh-huh.
It actually is very similar to Flying Cloud.
So what about people that don't have any aviation experience at all? Like, I'm sure people in your class.
Yeah, we had a couple of people that came from no aviation experience.
And were those the ones that didn't make
it? They passed.
They did?
They passed.
Okay.
There were people that had CTI experience and failed.
Didn't make it. Yeah. Okay, so it didn't matter.
Yeah, it doesn't
Interesting.
Matter. It literally doesn't matter. And and that's, you know, I'm discovering that's a theme with the profession is it really doesn't matter what your experience is because, you know, being at O'Hare, there's some people that, I mean, I haven't known any specifically, but from my coworkers, they tell me that people come from big facilities and they struggle and people come from little VFR towers and they do great.
And they're great, yeah.
And so it just depends on the person and your personal attitude and ability.
Right.
And
just desire.
You either can do it or you can't.
Yeah. So Academy Airport, it's a said 2 parallel or parallel runways.
Yeah. I mean, it's 2 parallel runways, a crossing runway. They have like airline traffic and GA traffic mixed in.
Okay. And they just set you up with different scenarios and they just walk you through like, hey, this is what we're seeing. This is what you should do.
They teach you all the rules, all the wake turbulence rules. Mm-hmm. Again, like I said, it's a really sterile environment.
Right.
There's no weather. I mean, they do like certain training scenarios for emergencies, but you're not evaluated on emergencies or anything like that.
Okay.
And they work you through, I can't remember how many scenarios that you actually worked, but over the couple of weeks of doing simulator problems, they work you up progressively in traffic volume.
Okay.
And so you end up getting really busy at the end, and then your evals come back from like the 110%, they come back down to a 70% level.
Okay.
And so again, the evals are super methodical and super slow.
Right.
And it's just supposed to be super objective and sterile. And they teach you how to really, like really the basics of air traffic. But again, it's...
You learn it once you get in the tower.
Yeah. It's a whole different world in a real facility.
So then when you show up to Burbank, what is the training like there? How do you start? Did you observe ground for months and then they let you do a little bit and then they move you? Then you observed, you know, an actual tower controller?
So, I mean, I got lucky with the timing that we showed up. There was a whole batch of trainees that were showing up right at the same time.
Okay.
And the manager at the time really like got classes scheduled and everything. And I got right into class for clearance delivery and ground, like a couple weeks after I was there.
Okay.
So it ended up going really fast. And then,
so they actually sit you down, or they like sit you in a classroom and like they start talking.
Yeah.
You
learn about
Burbank,
local procedures, local rules. And you know, you talk about, the overlying TRACON and the different sectors and which frequencies you need to know and what their airspace is and what our airspace is and what our procedures are and stuff. And that was like a week or two or something.
Sure.
And then you actually go upstairs and start training on clearance delivery, and then you certify on clearance, you train on ground. And then once you finish ground, at this point it was 7 months or so that I'd been there.
Okay. Yeah.
Six maybe. I can't remember.
So
exactly.
That summer roughly.
Yeah. That spring from January to like April or something.
Sure.
Was what it took for ground.
Yeah.
And then you go back to the class for local control, which is the tower, like the tower frequencies. Okay. And that was a week or two or something.
And these are just taught by the manager of the tower?
There was one of the controllers is designated to be the instructor for the,
got it,
the class there.
Yeah.
And then after that, you go upstairs and train on the local control position. Which at Burbank was more involved. It was a lot more difficult than ground.
Yeah.
And that took another 6 months or whatever. And then I checked out February of 2019, whatever the fall. Yeah. 2019.
Yeah.
The following year. So it took just over a year to get from when I started at Burbank to fully certifying.
And then you could just, so in that time, were you always with somebody like a trainer?
Right, yeah,
you're always paired with somebody.
Exactly. So all the positions have two headphone jacks that you can plug into.
Okay.
And so you plug into one and the instructor plugs into the other, and they have the ability to overkey you.
Right.
If they need to deconflict something.
I've heard that here. New controllers when I was flight instructing and stuff, and you'd hear them, they would say something and then another guy would step in. Wait, no.
Yeah.
This. So, got it. That's what I figured.
That's
exactly
what's happening. And
so then after February, it was just you then, right?
Right.
Then you could just, you could run them all and off you went.
Yeah. So then you're just being a controller, and it's a really cool feeling, similar to probably your first solo you're just kind of doing your own thing and you're making your own decisions. And training in air traffic is really, hard because there's a lot of, technique involved.
Sure.
Yeah. You can operate within the rules, but there's a million different ways to skin a cat.
Yeah.
And so being in training, you learn how your instructor wants things done.
Right.
And you end up doing it their way because that's how they want you to do it.
Yeah.
And then once you check out, you have the liberty to still work within the rules, but you can kind of, you know, experiment with new things
and
figure out what's actually good for you and how you want to work the problems and stuff like that. And so it's really fun to start to make your own decisions and not be second-guessed every moment of it. And that's the stage I'm at O'Hare right now. Is I checked out in like 6 months ago, and I'm still experimenting with new things. And and it is really fun, especially at O'Hare, because there's a million ways to do something at Burbank, and there's 10 times that at O'Hare.
Yeah.
There's so much more flexibility with a place like O'Hare, because all the airspace is built around that.
Right. Whereas Burbank, you kind of your hand is kind of forced with what SoCal is doing.
Really, really structured and really convoluted, and there's airspace everywhere.
It is. It's a mess.
And there's traffic everywhere, and they're all crossing everywhere.
Yeah.
Since the airspace around O'Hare is built for O'Hare,
right,
you can pretty much do, there's a lot of stuff.
As long as you're within the rules,
exactly,
you can do what you want.
Yeah.
That's cool.
So I actually got really lucky at Burbank. I checked out in February, and then in March, they had a bid to transfer people. Every like 3 or 4 months, they have a bid where you can transfer. And I was the person who checked out to make Burbank eligible to release somebody.
Okay.
And then I was the one that got released.
Released, yeah.
Like a month after I checked out.
And that's, is that based on seniority or?
No, it's purely staffing and priority of where people are trying to go.
Okay. And was the release, was that, were there other options besides O'Hare?
Yes and no. I mean, it's like, it's kind of hard to explain. Every facility, so there's this program called INCEPT, which is the process in which you use to transfer between facilities in the FAA.
Yeah.
And you essentially have to elect yourself to be in this process by putting in paperwork for the facilities that you want to go to.
Yeah.
So let's say you're working at Burbank and you want to go to Minneapolis, or you want to go to Dallas-Fort Worth, or you want to go to Miami or San Francisco or Boston. You can put the paperwork into all of those facilities.
Sure.
And there's no limit on how many places you can apply to, I guess.
Sure.
And going back to what I wanted out of the academy is I just wanted to be at a busy facility.
Right.
I didn't necessarily want to come back to Minneapolis or the Midwest even.
Yeah.
I just wanted to go to the DFWs or the Denvers or the Miamis or the Atlantas or whatever. And so I literally put in paperwork for all of those facilities.
Yeah.
And I kind of refer to the INCEPT as a lottery. And if you want to win a lottery ticket, you buy a million lottery tickets.
Yeah. Except these cost you nothing.
Yeah. Like I said, I got extremely lucky and ended up being able to release from Burbank that the following month.
That's crazy.
And the reason I got selected was because I had in for O'Hare, who was really high on the priority list of needing people.
Oh, sure.
And so the two lotteries of being able to release and putting in for somewhere that needs people lined up.
Yeah.
And
it just worked out.
It just worked out really well.
That makes sense. Yeah. Because there probably could have been people at Burbank that have been there for 10, 15 years trying to get out, but they didn't want O'Hare. Right?
Yeah. So, they wanted one specific facility that everybody wants or whatever.
They see Shane come in 1 month and then leave.
It was probably extremely frustrating for them, which I understand. I mean, it's a problem nationwide, is people want to go places and they can't go just because we're understaffed everywhere.
Yeah. And I mean, that kind of comes back to the pilot side of things though too, right? I mean, low time pilots looking for jobs, you know, if you're whatever, it doesn't matter your age and, you know, single or not, but a lot of the times the younger people that are single and they're willing to move wherever, they're the ones that are getting these unique, interesting jobs, you know, or the ones that are potentially getting hooked up with a jet job at 500 hours because they're willing to go to,
that'll be flexible,
you know, Meridian, Mississippi or something for some random thing. Yeah. Whereas like some other people that, you know, don't want to leave whichever city they're in, it doesn't work as well for them. But so when you were in Burbank and you were first on your own, did you have any moments of like, not because of, you know, the actual flying, but like any moments of panic where you like set yourself up into a situation? You're like, I need relief here. I need some help here. Like I might've got myself into a situation.
You know, not really.
Okay.
There was a couple scenarios where so we had crossing runways. We would depart one and land on the other.
Sure.
So it was a lot of, we call them squeeze plays, where you're rolling somebody for takeoff and you're trying to beat the arrival that's on final for the other runway.
Yeah.
This guy has to be through the intersection before the arrival gets to the threshold of the other runway.
Sure.
So there were a couple times that was a normal operation to run those pretty close sometimes.
Yeah.
But every once in a while, you'd be running one close, and then the guy on final would go around for some reason on his own.
Sure.
And so then you had two airplanes that are just newly airborne, basically, like, you know, that you have to separate and you got to work it out. And, but that, I mean, that's
nothing
pretty
crazy.
Much it. I would say another exciting scenario is when there's a, like a police chase or something. In LA.
Oh, sure.
Have you ever watched like a live stream of a police chase in LA?
I've seen some of it.
It's a whole thing.
Yeah.
In LA, it's a whole TV genre.
Yeah.
And so all the TV channels have their helicopters.
Oh yeah.
And the police have their helicopters.
And they're ripping through Burbank's airspace.
Yeah. And so you have one guy with a million police cars, and then you have three police helicopters and then seven TV helicopters that are all following this police chase. And if they're going to go on the 101 through Burbank airspace, they're going to come through and they're all going to check into Burbank Tower and they're going to say, Tower, Police 1, we're in pursuit of a guy. And then Police 2 is going to go, we're in pursuit. And then they're just all like in a, it looks like a beehive.
Swarm of bees.
Yeah, just following this highway.
Yeah.
So those get pretty hilarious sometimes. Dude,
I guess you don't even think about that.
Yeah. But I mean, they're VFR helicopters. So they're all talking to each other on their own, air-to-air radios and stuff. So we're just... I mean, we're just missing the swarm of bees, basically, with all the jet traffic and stuff. So those are exciting. Funny. The other exciting thing is fire season.
Okay.
Yeah. Because that's a really big thing in California.
Sure.
And there's a lot of, right before I got there, actually, the fall before I got there, the hill right next to Burbank, there was a really, really bad wildfire on the hill that was, it's within Burbank's airspace, like 2 or 3 miles away from the airport.
Sure.
And it went up in flames and, the DC-10 tankers and stuff would come do low passes over the hill.
Yeah.
Like 2 miles away from Burbank.
Yeah.
And they would talk to them, but you're not controlling them because they're inevitable. They're going to, they need to put the fire out. Yeah. You know, they're the priority at the time. And so they were saying it got pretty hilarious because this DC-10 would come out of nowhere, do a low pass over the hill, and then disappear and for a few minutes. You never know when they're going to come back.
Yeah.
Sometimes they would call, sometimes they wouldn't. But, you know, you had to be flexible and work around them.
Yeah, that's funny. That's stuff you don't really think about.
Yeah, that was pretty exciting. So
you get any of that at O'Hare now?
No.
No, not at
all. There's no wildfires. there's the occasionally occasional helicopter that comes in.
Police chase or something. But
It's not nearly as ridiculous as LA was.
Get the occasional 172 trying to
land. Yeah, actually, yeah. A couple months ago on the overnight shift, the Cessna came in and was like, can we do a touch and go? And I was like, yeah, sure.
Sure.
Yeah. there's no traffic at 2 in the morning.
So. Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about your transition to O'Hare and your training there. I think you briefly mentioned, but how long was your checkout process in O'Hare, and what was the learning curve like? Was it huge?
Yeah. Oh, it's unbelievable.
And how long have you been at O'Hare now?
I started in December right before COVID, so 2019.
Okay, so 2.5 years,
approaching 3 years.
I'm sure you're still learning stuff.
Oh, it's one of those things that you learn forever. You know, and if you're not learning forever, you're doing something wrong.
Yeah,
because there's so many variables. And
didn't you guys? So how many runways do you have there now? Six?
We have 6 parallels and 2 crossing.
Didn't you just open that 6th parallel recently?
Yeah. So 27 center, which is the new one, was opened in. November the spring, I think, of last year.
That's gotta be, you know, something for those people that have been there for a long time too. That's gotta be an interesting learning curve of stepping into, you know, what they've been doing for so long and now changing it up.
Well,
Another variable.
O'Hare's been under construction for the last 20 years practically. Yeah. I mean, they started this whole modernization project like in 2005 or 6 or something.
Yeah.
And they used to have a whole bunch of crossing parallel runways that they would use all of them at the same time. And so, like I mentioned, the squeeze plays at Burbank, it was like that on absolute steroids.
Oh, God.
They'd have like runways that crossed 2 other runways, and they would use both of those runways for rivals, and they would depart on the crossing runway, so it would be a double gap shot. You know?
Yeah.
Like, it's crazy.
Yeah.
And I have a lot of respect for the controllers that worked that, but, you know, it's way better to do parallel runways. It's just way safer. It's way more consistent and reliable. And,
I was looking up some stats yesterday, very brief. These were pre-COVID numbers, but roughly 900,000 operations annually.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you're pushing over 75 million passengers per year through there.
Yeah. So depending on the year, we teeter with Atlanta on being number 1 and 2 in the world with traffic.
It's crazy to watch. You know, there's a million spotters, you know, and stuff. It's cool to see some like night time lapses of all of the, you know, just on a nice clear night of all of the airplanes finals, coming in and taking off.
It's really cool.
It's insane.
Yeah, when I first started, on one of the swing shifts, I walked upstairs and they were landing all 3 runways. And you look out like 25 miles over the lake, and that's how long our finals are.
Yeah.
When it's like during a busy arrival rush and all three finals are all lined up, and it's a trip, man.
Yeah.
Like the first time I saw that, I was like, holy crap, that is cool.
Yeah.
And now it's still cool. Like you walk upstairs at night and you see the finals, and it's cool.
Yeah.
I mean,
what's your guys' busy time for?
We have a couple pushes throughout the day. So, I mean, the big morning push is the 9 o'clock push.
Okay.
Which is a lot of outbound traffic. Yeah. There's an inbound push at like 7:30 to 8:30.
Okay.
Then they all land, all the RJs land from their out stations, and then everybody transfers onto the big airplanes, and everybody flies out at 9.
Yep.
That's the big morning push. And then in the afternoon, we call it the 6 o'clock dumpster fire because it's really busy outbound, really busy inbound.
Sure.
And when the inbound and outbound traffic mix is when it gets really, really nuts at O'Hare.
Yeah.
And it's not as nuts as it was before COVID at the moment.
Okay.
But right now the summer schedules have turned over and it's starting to pick up again.
Yeah.
But before COVID, they'd call it the 6 o'clock dumpster fire, but it would start at 6 and it would last until 9:30 sometimes.
It'd go for hours.
Yeah. It'd be 3 hours of just constant busy traffic.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's getting back to that point. And I would say that's the hardest part of O'Hare is just the volume.
Sure.
Because there's just so much traffic. Having United as a main hub there and American as a main hub.
Yeah.
And with all the cargo stuff, like, there's just traffic all the time.
Nonstop. Yeah.
Even the slow hours it's steady, you know, in the in-between hours.
Yeah. What's your favorite... Too. So how do you guys split up your controllers there? You know, obviously during a busy, how many controllers I guess are working in the cab at any time? What are your guys' there's a lot of parts there. What are your guys' shifts like in lengths? And
so there's day shifts, there's swing shifts, and there's mid shifts. The day shifts are like 6 a.m. to 2.
Okay.
The swing shifts are 2 to 10 or 3 to 11, you know, roughly.
Something like
obviously
that.
There's overlap and stuff. Yep. There's a few different variations of the shift.
Yep.
And then the midnight is 10 to 6 a.m.
Okay.
So
do you guys switch on those? How does your schedule work like from?
Yeah. So the month? Everybody has two RDO. Well, we only have one RDO because we have overtime all the time. But normally you'd have two RDOs
what's an RDO?
Oh, regular day off. Sorry.
Got it.
It's one of those acronyms.
Yeah, there's a million of them out there.
And so your first day of work and your second day and your third day is a swing shift. And then your fourth and fifth day is a day shift.
Okay.
And then you work an overtime shift, which can be either of
something.
Them. Just depends.
Yeah.
That's for people that don't work the overnight shifts. And then the people that don't work the overnight shifts would be two swing shifts and then 2 days and then the overnight shift.
Okay.
To finish.
So you work in like a 5 day bucket.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then, okay. And do you bid for those like on a monthly basis?
You bid annually. So at the end of every year, you bid for the entire next year.
So what are you on?
I have Thursday, Friday off, but Friday night is my overtime. So I work Friday night overtime, Saturday night overtime, or Saturday night, Sunday night, Monday night, and then Tuesday, Wednesday morning.
Okay, cool.
And then I have Thursday off and then do it all again.
And you do it all over. I'll make sure to come in on the weekend that night.
Yeah, for sure.
Shana,
it's pretty hilarious because I get into work on Friday afternoon for my overtime and, you know, pilots don't know. So they'll say like, have a good weekend or, you know, it's like contact departure, we'll see you. Like, have a good weekend. I'm like, I just got here.
Yeah.
I had a great weekend already.
Yeah. My weekend's done.
Thanks for rubbing it in.
I was just talking about that the other day. It's kind of funny, you know, being on, obviously your schedule's kind of set, but you still got some days off during the week. Like the other day, you know, I had a Tuesday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday off.
Yeah.
And it's like Tuesday at noon and I'm like out and about and I'm like, what are you guys doing? And it's like busy. I'm like, what are you people doing? Don't you guys work?
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly.
And they're thinking the same thing about me. They're like, what is this kid doing out here? Doesn't he work?
Yeah, right. Get a job.
I'm like, I do work, but generally on the weekends and at night.
Yeah. So all those schedules, there's overlap and stuff.
Yeah.
And there's always, we try to have, the goal is to have 16 people on each shift.
Okay.
And, so that allows enough break rotations to happen and stuff. And,
sure.
And so at any given time, there's 10 or 12 people up in the tower.
Wow.
Sometimes more if there's a weather event,
Sure.
Like thunderstorms or snow or something, we have to open additional positions and have more traffic management people involved for swaps and thunderstorms and stuff. SWAP, it stands for Severe Weather Avoidance Plan.
Okay, yeah.
So in the summer when there's a whole bunch of reroutes and stuff, we call it a SWAP event. So there's basically a local control for each runway.
Okay.
And there, we actually have three physical towers at O'Hare.
Oh, okay, yeah.
The main tower in the middle does most of the work just because of... The outer two towers were built just because there's no line of sight from the main tower to the outer most runways.
Okay. Yeah.
And for to apply certain rules, you need to see airplanes.
Right.
You need to be able to see the runway.
Yeah.
So they built the outer towers to work the outermost runways.
Okay.
And so those towers have a local and a ground control.
Okay.
And then the main tower has the rest of the locals for the rest of the runways. And then there's two main ground positions in the main tower. Okay. We actually do it differently than every other airport in the country. Every other airport, they split grounds geographically. So they might have a west ground and an east ground or a north ground and a south ground.
Yeah.
We have an inbound and an outbound ground.
Okay.
And those two controllers share the entire airport.
Yeah.
So one of them works all the inbound traffic
and
the other works all the outbound traffic. And there are certain normal flows that everybody uses.
Yeah.
But they share the taxiways at the same time.
That was one of the things I had here was, so I've only flown into O'Hare just once actually. And it was at night and it was fine. But so I haven't got to experience it a whole lot, but the kind of just like the whole keep it moving concept of like, just keep going in that direction. Yeah. Don't stop.
Well, and it works. Yeah. I mean, so like, you can tell the people that are based at O'Hare and the people that aren't because the people that are based at O'Hare, usually all like the envoys and the SkyWest, the RJs that are there all the time.
Yeah.
They know the normal taxi routes and they just get into the flow and they go. And I mean, sometimes it gets so congested on the frequency that you just can't talk to every single airplane.
Yeah.
You can't help everybody get to exactly where they're going. And so you just,
kind of like
the pilots just gotta, or you might park at in a pad with an occupied gate and then your gate opens up, but the controller's so busy that you can't get a word in. And so,
just kind of join it and go to the gate.
Join into the flow. I'm not condoning this for anybody listening. Don't just do that. But I'm not saying that anybody would get in trouble if you did. So, as long as you get into the flow and nobody's really going to notice.
I've heard too, I was actually talking to a captain the other day. He was saying, that if you're trying to get into your gate and you're on, you know, I don't know the taxiways off the top of my head, but if you're on it and the gate's occupied, you know, at Minneapolis, you can just stop on one of the taxiways and you can just wait. And, you know, obviously if they need to move you, they will.
Right.
But there's nowhere for you to go, right? Because they're dead end. Whereas like he was saying, just get back on the taxiway and go back around on the loop and come back around.
So we call it the main core. It's the Alpha and Bravo taxiways.
That's what it is.
That have a bunch of connectors between the two at regular intervals.
Yeah.
And the connector taxiways are kind of associated with the lines in the alleyways. And so we'll just say like taxi via Bravo to your ramp, and the pilots are supposed to just infer where they're supposed to go in based on where their gate is and where their entryway into the alley is.
Yeah.
And for the most part, it works great. They'll just peel off the taxiway where they need to go and they go into the ramp and that's it. But because of the whole inbound and outbound dynamic, there might be 10 inbounds on Bravo and there might be 10 outbounds on Bravo that are all intermixed.
Sure.
And so if inbound has an airplane that stops on the taxiway, there might be 8 airplanes behind them that are right behind them.
Yeah.
And some of them are outbound, some of them are inbounds. Outbound's trying to make a plan with their sequence and their runway balance and stuff. And if one airplane stops, they all bunch up and it takes several minutes to get moving again.
Yeah.
And so it throws everybody's plan out the window and you have
to... don't be the guy that stops
on
the
taxiway. It really is a cardinal rule because there's so much volume on those two core taxiways, it can really jack up the flow if one airplane stops for a long period of time.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, when I was when we were taxiing out of there that night, the you know, it wasn't that busy, and I was able to get a ground call in, but they're like, yeah, you see the RJ up there on the right? Yes. Follow them. I'm like, okay.
Just do
what they do. I'm like, okay, hopefully they do the right thing.
Yeah.
But, you know, they're like, yeah, just follow them. And I'm like, okay. And we did, you know, we followed them all the way around and got to where we were going. But I'm just like, I was ready with a pen. You know, everybody talks about O'Hare, the crazy taxi instructions.
Well, that's why we use it, because sometimes the taxi instructions get so convoluted that it's easier to just follow.
Like, to tell, somebody tell going, one and then tell everybody behind them to follow. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I was ready. I was like, all right, here we go. This is going to be a million things. And they're like, just follow that.
Well, and it's really fun during the departure pushes on outbound, because the alleys, the ramp will line up the alleyways on both lines with maybe four or five deep of airplanes.
Sure.
And so it's really fun if all of them go to the same runway, because you tell the first guy on the east line to taxi the runway, and you tell the second guy to taxi the runway via follow him, and you tell the third guy to follow, fourth guy to follow, and you tell the first guy on the next line to follow the fourth airplane out of the left, and then they just all follow each other out of the alley.
Conga line
and that's it.
Eight airplanes,
and then you're done.
Yeah.
So it actually does really help the frequency congestion when you get a lot of follows in there. So,
what's your favorite position to operate?
I really like outbound a lot.
Okay. On ground.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause it's hard. I mean, there's a lot to do. You have to sequence airplanes to the runway so that local can always be rolling airplanes.
Sure.
So we have one SID at O'Hare, just one.
The O'Hare 7 or something.
And on that SID, there's a whole bunch of different fixes. There's a couple northbounds. There's three eastbound fixes. There's five southbound fixes and four westbound fixes. And
it's Pumpkin, one of those fixes.
Pumpkin is.
That's the north,
that's
right?
That's the north. Yeah. Pumpkin and Rainer. And so the goal as the outbound ground controller is to provide a sequence to the local controller so that they can always roll 6,000 feet in airborne. That's the minimum separation you need on the runway between departures.
Okay, 6,000 feet.
So if you roll two airplanes 6,000 feet in airborne, they will get into the air about a mile and a half or 2 miles apart.
Okay.
Which isn't enough for radar separation.
Sure.
So if you have, like, let's say off of 28 right, which is a normal westbound departure runway, and you give them two back-to-back westbound fixes. Mm-hmm. You need to have those airplanes 3 miles apart before you ship them to the Turrican, because that's what the standard separation is.
Sure.
But if you roll 6,000 feet in airborne, you're not going to have it. Does that make sense?
Tell me about 6,000 feet in airborne.
So 6,000 feet down the runway.
Okay.
The first aircraft has to be airborne before the second one starts rolling.
Got it. Okay.
It's just one of those separation rules. Yeah.
Okay. So if you do that, you'll have the separation, or you won't have
you
the separation.
Won't.
Okay.
So
you have to wait until they're far enough away.
Yeah. So you have to stop rolling, right? Okay. So it slows the traffic down.
So do you try
as ground, the goal as ground is to put a westbound and then a northbound and then a westbound and a northbound.
Okay.
So that local can roll everybody 6,000 feet in airborne and they're turning different directions.
Right. And then by the time the two westbounds are gone, they have their 3 miles
three or four
of separation.
Mile,
okay. That makes sense.
So that way local can just keep rolling and rolling and rolling, and it's the most efficient. Yeah. And a good ground controller will sequence airplanes in that manner. And so that's half of the job. The other half is the runway balance. So we normally have two departure runways.
Okay.
On any flow.
Yeah.
That's the goal. And the outbound controller has the liberty of deciding which departure fixes are going to which runway. Mm-hmm. And so they will decide based on how much volume is going in either direction, which runways to send certain fixes.
Okay.
So, like, if there was a lot of southbound volume, they could take some of the southbound volume to one runway and mm-hmm. some of the southbound volume to the other runway to mm-hmm. balance the two runways so that they each have traffic, and so that you're maximizing
continuously rolling them all, not just stacking up all the southbounds behind one.
Yep. Exactly. So that's what's fun about outbound, is because there's a lot of decision making that goes into it, and you can either be really good at it or you can be really average at it.
Yeah.
And does
it show?
It does, totally. Yeah. And even just between one person. Some days it's just like the airplanes come out of the ramps and it's easy to make a sequence, and sometimes it's not.
Yeah.
And then you add weather into it and it can be really, really challenging. And, you know, then they start adding restrictions on the departures where you know, you need your westbounds all 10 miles in trail. And then instead of putting one in between the one airplane in between westbounds, you have to put three or four. That's
right.
So that local can always be rolling.
Right.
So that's why I like Alpine a lot. Cause it's,
yeah, that
there's a
like
lot
fun.
Of, it's a lot of decisions that you have
it
to seems, make.
It's interesting because, Joe from Minneapolis, he too likes ground. Right. Cause it's the same, you know,
yeah.
It's obviously Minneapolis isn't as busy as Chicago,
but it has its moments,
but
it
totally does.
Yeah.
And, but still like to him, you know, he was like, that's where the challenge is. Right. Right. He's like, you know, not saying it's easy or hard to run the tower or the locals on the runways, but he was like, you're just clearing for people for takeoff and for landing. You know, it's like
right. where it's you a little really bit more monotonous,
to, right? Yeah. You really have to plan a little bit more when you're running ground and right. getting people around. So which is interesting because I feel like as an air traffic controller, a lot of people don't even think about them operating. You know, the ground. A lot of them think about them once mm-hmm. they're in the air.
Right.
So it's kind of cool. So what does the, I actually did have a question before that. What level is O'Hare?
You were talking about 12.
It is a 12. It's yep. the top. It's got to be the top. Right? Mm-hmm. That's what I thought.
Yeah.
How many 12s are there?
Oh gosh.
A lot?
Like tower onlys? No. There's not a ton of tower only level 12s. So O'Hare, DFW, Atlanta, Miami's a 12, but they're actually an up down. The Tracon is combined with the tower.
Okay.
I might be missing another. LAX is another 12. And Denver.
Got it.
And I think those are all the standalone level 12 towers.
Okay. That's cool.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's a lot of level 12 centers, obviously, just because
right.
they have more volume.
But, totally.
And a lot of level 12 Tracons.
Sure. But the standalone level 12 tower.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
So what does the future look like, right? You're at level 12. You're at O'Hare. You're in the tower.
You know, I've been trying to figure that out myself.
Do you ever see yourself going into like a training position, a management position, supervisor?
I don't want to get into management.
Yeah.
But everybody does become a trainer.
Okay.
At one point in their career.
Sure.
And I'm excited for that. I think it would be interesting. I'm the type of person that I want to, if I'm going to do something, I want to do it well.
Sure.
And it's the FAA struggles with teaching people how to teach.
Yeah.
And so I need to, and I don't have any formal training in instructing or anything like that. Yeah. And so if I were to get into that, I think I need to. I want to do it well. I don't want to just be one of those
seminar
backseat instructors.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. But yeah, I mean, there's so many different avenues to go down in air traffic.
Mm-hmm.
There's just being a controller is one of them, but there's also traffic management, who are the people that are doing kind of big picture, strategic planning and stuff. Yeah. So each center has their own traffic management unit.
Okay.
And, they're the ones making big picture decisions with the command center, which is in Virginia.
Sure.
Who is like a TMU for the entire country.
Okay. Yeah.
And, they're making decisions about where traffic needs to go and routings and where certain weather systems are going to impact traffic flows and stuff. And which airports need to implement delay programs because there's too much volume or because they're losing runways or, you know, whatever. And I think that's a really interesting avenue to go down.
Yeah.
So I don't know, maybe someday, but
yeah, for now, enjoying O'Hare.
Yeah, it's
that's awesome.
Fun.
So. Do you got any parting advice, words for those wanting to get into air traffic control?
Yeah, I'd say go for it. I mean, be ready for it's not easy.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say the training is the part that's not easy.
Right.
Once you're done training, it's like any other job. It has its moments where it's very difficult.
Yeah.
But day to day, it's routine.
Yeah.
And it's well worth the bad days.
Good.
But yeah, I would say just figure out what you love and do what you love, because every job eventually turns into just a job.
Yeah.
You know, and I think there's a point where you become a master of your job, and if you stop growing as a professional, you're going to run out of motivation.
Yeah.
And so that's what I'm struggling with, or not struggling, but I'm trying to figure out how to continue
your motivation. You got to plan.
Yeah, you got to plan. figure out how to stay motivated for years, because it's a long life, and you gotta stay motivated, and you gotta be the best that you can be, or else you're gonna lose motivation.
That's awesome. So, well, should we do a little trivia?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. So this one, we'll see how you. I have all the faith in you. This one's kind of cool. I'm gonna give you the. I've got what, 3, 6, like 9.
Okay.
9. Yeah, I might add another something here, but 9 airlines. And just want you to give me the country that they're from.
Okay.
Right, like Delta, US, you know. Start out with the easy one, Aer Lingus.
Ireland.
Ireland is correct. Nice. Qantas.
Australia.
Australia. And did you know that Qantas is actually an acronym?
Oh, really? No,
it's
I didn't
not
know.
A word. Oh, I found this out the other day. I want to see what it stands for here. It was like, Queensland and Northern Territory Aerial Services.
Cool.
There you go. Yeah. Qantas. Qantas.
Hmm.
All right. Australia. Another easy one here. KLM.
The Netherlands.
The Netherlands, yes. Yeah. Emirates?
United Arab Emirates.
That's right. There you go. All Nippon.
Japan.
Japan, indeed. EVA?
I want to say like Taiwan.
Taiwan, yeah. Okay. I think maybe LOT, LOT.
Poland.
Mm-hmm. Oh, man, you're good.
They all come to O'Hare, man.
Yeah, that's why we did it. We
it says it. On the side Polish Airlines. So.
That's why we chose chose ones that come there.
Oh, okay.
Etihad?
That one. Oh, wait a second. Oh, man. Is that like... yeah, you know what? I don't know that one.
You already gave it away in a previous answer. It's the same country as one of the previous ones.
Is it?
Uh-huh.
Is it like Saudi Arabia or...
UAE.
Oh, United is that Arab all Emirates? The same? Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay.
Well. Emirates and Etihad.
Okay.
Nice. Viva Aerobus.
It's one of those Southern American countries.
Yeah.
But I don't know which one.
Mexico.
Oh, it is Mexico.
Yeah.
Oh, darn.
That's all right.
That's embarrassing.
What about Azul?
Azul. I'm bad at those ones, man.
I don't even know if Azul flies to O'Hare.
No, that one doesn't fly to O'Hare.
I just made
is it
that
Costa
one
Rica or something?
Brazil.
Like Brazil. Okay.
Yeah. Last one, Cathay Pacific. This one is, you know, depends how we define country or region, city, territory, city.
I'm going to say China.
Yeah, Hong Kong.
Okay. So, yeah.
There you go.
Cool.
Well, nice job. Stumped you on a couple.
Yeah.
Hey, that's good. But
it's funny because we see them all the time and we're like, oh, yeah, I know where Etihad is.
Yeah.
And, oh, wait, no.
I know that. That's why I was thinking about these and I'm like, you know, there's obviously like we stuck with ones that were, you know, basically O'Hare specific, but like you could have got some weird, you know, there's some weird airlines out there
that
you could get absolutely just stumped on. But well, cool, man. That was fun.
Yeah, that was great.
Any
thanks for having
final
me.
Words you want to say or anything you want to talk about?
No, I mean, if anybody wants to follow me on Instagram,
yeah, a little plug,
Shane Van Hoven. If you have any questions or anything about
the DMs are open, huh?
Yeah, for sweet, sure. Man. About O'Hare or traffic or anything like that.
Cool.
I don't have an ace camp or anything. Like
no. Yeah. Bummer.
Maybe,
there you go. That's,
maybe
what,
someday,
you, that's
yeah.
what you could start. You could start the, Shane Van Hoven ace
looking
camp.
At it, yeah. Thinking about something, but
that'd be cool.
Yeah. It'd be cool to get people involved a little bit more. And aviation's so hard to get involved with already. So.
For sure.
It's great that they do that up here.
Yeah, there's a lot of good events. I wish I would have done more of them as a kid, but I didn't know about any of them. So, all right, man.
Cool.
Well, thanks for stopping in.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Awesome, dude.
This was another episode of Living in Flight. If you liked this episode, please make sure to subscribe for more exclusive aviation content. Have any topic ideas or want to be featured on our podcast? Send us a message at listen@livinginflight.com. Thank you for joining us. And until next time, this is Living in Flight.